with a goblin walking quietly over the universe from end to end. Others followed him. They were not aggressive creatures. It was that made them so terrible to Helen. They merely observed in passing that there was no such thing as splendor or heroism in the world. Beethoven chose to make it all right in the end. He built the ramparts up. He blew with his mouth for a second time. And again the goblins were scattered. He brought back the gusts of splendor, the heroism, the youth, the magnificence of life and of death. And amid roarings of a superhuman joy, he led his Fifth Symphony to its conclusion. But the goblins were there. They could return. He said so bravely. And that is why one can trust Beethoven when he says other things. Now that mood which is in Forster seems to me to break up in this satirical, despairing, self-pitying mood which followed the First World War, though it did not follow the Second. One can see it very clearly if one turns back once again to the early novels of Mr. Aldous Huxley. Huxley, in many ways, is the barometer of this whole period. Although perhaps that's a little unfair, because a barometer is an instrument which is alleged to tell you when the weather changes. Huxley is a sort of barometer that is partly responsible for changing the weather. But in those early novels, he did give, and I think it's a definite creative contribution to the literature of this period. He did give that sense that a civilization was breaking up and that humanity had not the resources to redevelop. If I may quote a single passage, there is a description in Antique Hay by Gumbrel Sr. And what absurd names Huxley did always give to his characters, as if he didn't want you to believe in them. Where Gumbrel Sr. is describing the life of Sir Christopher Wren. Sir Christopher Wren, who built so many beautiful churches in London and St. Paul's, but who rarely wished to replan London after the Great Fire of London. And the point of Huxley's passage is how rarely England didn't want a planned city. It didn't want order. He offered them open spaces and broad streets. He offered them sunlight and air and cleanliness. He offered them beauty, order, grandeur. He offered to build for the imagination and for the ambitious spirit of man, so that even the most bestial, vaguely and remotely, as they walked those streets, might feel that they were of the same race, or very nearly, as Michelangelo. That they might feel themselves in spirit at least, magnificent, strong, and free. He offered them all these things. He drew a plan for them, walking in peril among the still smoldering ruins. But they preferred to erect the old, intricate squalor. They preferred the medieval darkness and crooked and beastly irregular quaintness. They preferred holes and crannies and winding tunnels. They preferred foul smells. Sunless, stagnant air, phthisis and riches. They preferred ugliness and pettiness and dirt. They preferred the wretched human scale, the scale of the sickly body and not the mind. Now, I think it's that sense that one finds in Huxley, which is present in a number of the other writers who make the genuinely creative contribution in this period. For instance, if one turns to the work of Mr. Eliot, the brilliant contribution, the poem which I think must survive and which has already answered so much in the thought and in the feeling of these present generations, is The Wasteland. And one has to remember how very early that poem was. The poem of the year 1922. A poem which is a symbolic, representative poem in the period. In a work of just a little more than 400 lines, from which all realism and all narrative has been removed, Eliot somehow contrived, as if it were in an extended metaphor, to give a symbol of a world which is being fragmented and broken. It's true that Eliot doesn't stay there, doesn't stop. It may be that that little note that Mr. I. Richards wrote in his footnote to Science and Poetry led him to trouble, to be troubled by the fact that the poem had no faith and no belief in it. And Eliot moves out from the position which he had taken up in the wasteland and becomes a Christian poet. But there is this strange conclusion that although you may prefer the idea, the outlook, which is represented by the later and definitely Christian poems of Eliot, there is a diminution of creative strength as soon as the positive solution has been accepted. It's exactly the same in the work of Huxley. The creative boldness, the creative integrity, lies in the early and destructive novel. When he passes over from that to the perennial philosophy, or to the later work, where he discovers to his own satisfaction a positive, philosophical, complete solution. Something dies within him as far as his creative work is concerned. The later work, both in the case of Hopkins and of Eliot, is interesting. But something has passed out. I cannot myself find any explanation for this, although I find it as the most common phenomenon throughout this literature, throughout the literature of this period. Something very similar happens in the work of D.H. Lawrence. Lawrence, who is achieving a new popularity in England during this last year. The Penguin Library, which is a certain recording of popular taste, has recently decided to publish 1 million copies of Lawrence's work. So there'll be a large reading public for them in England during the next few months. And Mr. Richard Aldington has written a life. Now, it seems to me that in Lawrence, in the early work, in Sons and Lovers, in the letters, in the essays, and indeed in certain sections of the later work, where he is content to record, where he is completely faithful to what is there, a sort of realistic picture of his time, there is a magnificent creative strength, particularly when that observation goes towards nature. There is something which is difficult to find a parallel for it in English literature. But there is a messianic element in Lawrence. He is not satisfied with what Keats once described as the negative capability. He is determined to complete the picture of ideas inside his own mind and to transfer into that into his creative work. And there is surely some weakening, some diminution of strength when that occurs. I feel that the same condition is also true of Joyce. Although with Joyce it works rather the other way round. Joyce has broken with his Catholicism in the same way as he's broken with Dublin before the major works are produced. And therefore, the major works do remain with Joyce. This picture of a mind and of a society which has no unity, which is in fragments. And that, I think, is why in Joyce there is an increasing strength, not, as with the other writers that I have mentioned, not an increasing strength, but a certain sense of weakness. I regard this phenomenon as one of the most important that comes through from this literature of the period between the wars. It is this sense of embarrassment and difficulty in which the creative writer finds himself. Partly, I think, because he never reaches a sense of integration with the society in which he finds himself. Matthew Arnold, in the first essays of the Essays in Criticism, the first series of the Essays in Criticism, wrote that in the Greece of Pindar and Sophocles, in the England of Shakespeare, the poet lived in a current of ideas, in the highest degree animating and nourishing to the creative power. Society was, in the fullest measure, permeated by fresh thought, intelligence, and alive. Now, there is no such relation between society and the genuine creative writer throughout this period between the two wars. Having said that, and having felt that I am dealing for the moment perhaps with a particular group of writers, writers certainly of a certain age, I do recall, and does obviously recall, that one's leaving out a great deal, and leaving out one or two figures who must not be left out, and who will not adjust themselves to the generalizations that I am making. One has to remember, for instance, Mr. Shaw was there. Mr. Shaw had been there ever since 1885, and he's still there today. In fact, there is nobody of living memory who can recall a time when Mr. Shaw was not writing, except Mr. Shaw. And when one thinks of the actual contribution made by any single writer, then the contribution of Shaw, even that section of it, which lies in this period in between the wars, is a major contribution. One regards only three plays, Heartbreak House, St. Joe, The Apple Cart. One goes no further. Is there anything that can easily compare in this period between the two wars with those three plays? And yet I find that there is some difference between Shaw's outlook and the outlook of the writers to whom I have been just referring. I find it difficult to define. I sometimes wonder if it is not that Shaw, although his thought is revolutionary, lived all the major decades of his early life in a society which was secure and permanent. He lived during the period of his early maturity in a period before Western civilization had conceived of the possibility that it also was mortal. And therefore, that although Shaw, for instance, as in Man and Superman, is revolutionary and iconoclastic, he does it with the confidence that he won't succeed. He does it from a sense of physical, economic security. He feels that he is able to be reckless in attacking a society because that society is so strong. I think it's also combined with a sense of physical fastidiousness, which, although it is prepared to describe violence, wishes personally to avoid violence. This may be a very un-Irish quality, but it's present there in that sort of rather romantic physical fastidiousness, which amounts to fear, which I think is present and permanently present in Shaw. This may seem a somewhat cruel thing to say, particularly to say of one whom I personally so much admire. But I'm only saying something that Shaw has himself said. When the revolution comes, do not expect to find me on the barricades. I shall be under the bed. Is that something which separates him from the generation which has grown up with this sense that Western civilization may have so suffered that it cannot recover, and which at least is aware of an increasing precarious